Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord.
Everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And as that excellent musical parody on the voice of Kenneth Copeland, courtesy of WTF Bra, fades into the background, welcome to the third of our movie review podcasts here at TMR. Many of you remember that, first of all, we talked about The Brotherhood of the Bell several weeks ago, and then most recently, the second one was on the film Batman from 1966, which was a very revelatory program on a special day. But today, with the third of our series here, we have a discussion on the 1995 science fiction film noir, directed by Terry Gilliam, 12 Monkeys, starring Bruce Willis and Madeleine Stowe. And I just want to add, as in fact I did mention last time, that it is not my intention for TMR to become a kind of movie review podcast. It's just that at the moment, due to all the chaos created by the coronavirus, with constantly changing work patterns and childcare, etc., it's extremely difficult to arrange interviews. At least that's what I'm finding, but very much easier to chat with friends of the show who are therefore infinitely flexible. So thank you very much, chaps, for being infinitely flexible here. Our infinitely flexible guests are today Frank Johnson of Ancient Aliens Debunked and GK of Like Flint Radio. Gentlemen, welcome to the show, indeed to the TMR movie review series.
Thank you, Julian. Thanks for the invite.
Good day, Julian. Thanks for having me on. And to emphasize how flexible I am, I've been stretching for the last half hour. So,
yes, it's actually a weird situation, isn't it? Because it's very, very late for you, Frank, and it's sort of middle of the afternoon for you, GK, but it's early morning for me. So we're all in sort of different states of consciousness.
Yes. And it also may prove that the Earth is round, maybe. So,
we've gone global, Julian. Your show's gone global.
I'm very glad. I'm very glad about that. how are you both coping with the coronavirus situation? How are things going in Australia, GK?
Well, I think like most of us, I'm not particularly enjoying it. Some of the restrictions are just a little bit too tight because we're under very similar to restrictions to, I think, the UK and the rest of the world. But one of the problems we have here in Australia is that the restrictions differ between states and territories. So some of us are confused about what we can and cannot do. Maybe we'll talk about it a bit more later. But down here, because we've got the different states, we can't work out who's supposed to do what.
Yeah, indeed. My wife is having difficulty with that with her work and people not knowing whether they should be at work or not. And it's very, very tricky. Frank, how are things for you over there in California?
You know, I have to say it's almost the exact same as before. I mean, because I don't get out and do much. So it's like going out and doing much isn't really affecting me. You know, with everything closed, I mean, it's weird. There's less traffic going to work. So my 1 hour commute is now like a half hour. I'd say the biggest way it's affecting me personally is to go to different stores. They're requiring you to wear some sort of a mask. And the majority of stores I'm going to, like, you know, Target, Walmart's, grocery stores, in addition to the mask, they're, I guess, requiring you to wait in a line outside so they can limit how many people are going into the store. That's probably, to me, the most annoying thing. But everything else seems to be more or less the same for me. I suppose for other people it's different. I think a lot of people aren't going to work. But yeah, just a little bit more of a weirder version of my normal life already. So
yes, and this business of standing 2 meters apart waiting to go into a shop is not a very pleasant experience. I was doing it the other day and the person right in front of me was constantly coughing.
Oh no. So
It's probably fine, but, you know, it just makes you think, oh, heck. Anyway, I stood my ground. We'll see if I'm going to be all right in a few days from now. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to talk about this film, 12 Monkeys. And I suppose a good way of starting really would be just for us to give our brief impressions of the film. So, GK, brief impressions of what you thought about it.
My wife and I watched it recently, Julian. I have seen it before. And the first thing that struck me was, and I said it to my wife, this is as good as I remember it. Mm. So I am somewhat a fan of the film. I like the idea. I am a bit of a fan of sort of post-apocalyptic movies anyway, and this is a good one. Has a similar feel to Gilliam's earlier movie, Brazil. That was the big thing that hit me as soon as I watched it, because I went, oh, well, I'm saying that is only a couple of months ago I watched Brazil again. Mm. I'm not a fan of the Brazil movie, so there you go. Right. But they've got a similar feel to them, you know, just in sets and imagery and things like that. But they're two different films, and so one I'm a fan of and the other I'm not. But, yes, I like the movie.
Yeah, I picked up on that as well. It's a sort of grotesque quality, I think, that it shares with Brazil.
Mm. Yeah, good way to put it, yeah.
Frank, general thoughts about the film?
Yeah, I'm glad GK pointed out it's kind of got a lot of visual similarities to Brazil, at least the scenes in the future. Certain parts of Brazil had some really weird set designs, like very like real and very dark. Kind of reminded me of this French movie called City of Lost Children, and also the movie Dark City. It's kind of got this dark aesthetic and kind of harsh industrial look. And that's one of the things I like about Gilliam's movies. And I actually was a fan of Brazil, and so in contrast to GK, I think he's right to mention that if you've seen that movie, you'll pick up a lot of visual similarities. Hmm. This is a movie I've seen a few times. I think the first time I ever saw it was maybe in my early 20s in the 2000s, and I had never seen it before. I didn't really know what it was about, and the first time I saw it, I think I watched it a couple of times, like back to back, and it just kind of like blew my mind at the time. I'm like, wow, this is crazy. And then the ending, and I'm sure we'll get to that later, I'm just like, wow, what does that mean? And even when I think I understand the ending, I go back and rethink. I'm like, did that really mean what I think it is? So I think that's, I think this movie is one that it gets you to think. And then just as the characters in the movie do.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that the film poses questions of the viewer. It doesn't really answer anything, does it? And I think if you do try to analyze things too deeply, well, at least I come away thinking, actually, I'm not sure that makes any sense. But it doesn't really matter because it's posing questions, I think, which you can then go and think of in your own way afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah. And that brings it, I think, in a way, it's like a very circular movie. I mean, the story is basically circular.
Like circular reasoning.
There's the characters go through basically circulars in their plots, and it's just I don't know, just things just keep changing as like keep repeating themselves too in certain ways. Mm. And you go through circular reasoning trying to analyze what's going on.
Yeah. Well, this is a film that I thought I had seen before, but it turns out I haven't. I think what must have happened was that I started watching it years ago and fell asleep or something. Because actually, when I watched it a few days ago for this movie review podcast, I was not gripped by the opening. I thought it was really slow to start with and really off-putting because it was just so grotesque and unengaging that I thought, and maybe that's why I didn't stay awake the first time to watch it. But obviously this time I stuck with it and I thought it was a good movie actually by the end, you know, that it did actually pose these really very interesting questions without giving answers. And it was quite gripping once it got, I don't know, about 10 minutes into the movie. I was very much hooked by it. Mm. So I thought what I should do before we discuss any more about it in any detail is to give a little bit of a synopsis about it for those people who saw it years and years ago and forgotten much about it, or if you've not seen it before. So this very convoluted plot, very briefly described. So the film opens in 2035, and we learn that a virus has killed 5 billion people back in 1996 because, and this is what is believed, because a group, so it is believed, called the Army of the 12 Monkeys has deliberately released a virus. And ever since, people have been living underground. And a cure is therefore wanted for this virus. And so the scientists in 2035, in very time-honored fashion in movies, decide to send someone back in time to get some of this original virus. Now, why they have to get the original virus, I don't know, but that's not explained, but that's what they need to do. So a prisoner called James Cole, who is played by Bruce Willis, is chosen for this. He's trained up and he's sent back in time. And crucially, and this is really crucial for the film, he has this recurring dream, question as to whether it's a dream or not, but he has a recurring dream that haunts him of a young woman and a man being shot as witnessed by a young boy. Now, the young boy turns out to be himself, carrying on here. Anyway, he's sent back in time, but he's sent to the wrong time. He's sent to 1990. And he ends up in a mental asylum under the care of a coincidentally beautiful psychiatrist called Dr. Catherine Riley, who's played by Madeleine Stowe. Anyway, this character, James Cole, goes back and forth through time on various stages of his mission. And he gets caught up accidentally. I'm not sure if it's accidental or not. He gets caught up in World War One. I have to say, I found this quite amusing when it was happening. It just seemed so bizarre. Anyway, he gets caught up in World War One, where he sustains a bullet wound to the leg. And that turns out to be crucial because a photograph is taken of him in the 1914-18 war. And that photograph later convinces Dr. Catherine Riley that he's telling the truth after all his time travel and this impending virus outbreak that's going to kill 5/7 of the world or whatever it is. Anyway, so now that she's convinced by him, and the two of them are naturally enough in love in the Hollywood world, she and James set off to the airport just before the outbreak, and they discover at the last minute that the Army of the 12 Monkeys was not responsible for the virus outbreak after all. They were just interested in releasing a load of animals into the wild as fanatical environmentalists, and rather they discover another character called Dr. Peters, who's played by David Morse, is setting off to fly to various places to release this deadly virus. And crucially, right at the end of the film, and no doubt we'll discuss this in some detail in a bit, crucially, there's a scene where James Cole's dream, in inverted commas, turns out to be a memory. The dream comes true, and this guy, Dr. Peters, is recognized, and James Cole goes after him, and then James Cole is shot, and the young lady turns out to be Dr. Catherine Riley, and this boy who's looking on the scene turns out, of course, to be the very young Cole looking at his own death in real time. So you have this kind of time loop thing going on right at the end of the movie. That is basically the movie in a nutshell. Was there anything crucial that you think I missed out of that?
I think if we start picking that apart, we'll be here all night discussing the movie, because it seems to me that every scene is essential, but I think it's a good synopsis. In addition to your synopsis, I would say, based on his memory and his dream, you're kind of left with the question, is he changing time or is he not? You know,
yeah.
You get the impression towards the end that he didn't, but there's a few changes in some of his memories as he finds out more information, like details in his dream change. And you're wondering, is it his memory or is it because he changed time? You know, so it's one of the things you look for as you watch it. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I do want to discuss the theme of time. There are a number of themes in this movie that we will go on to discuss. But before we get on to that, how about sort of general things about the production itself? And what did you think of the acting? I mean, I thought that I was really impressed by Brad Pitt's performance. He hasn't been mentioned in the synopsis there because there was too much to mention. But he plays this guy called Jeffrey Goines, who's sort of in charge of the 12 Monkeys. You know, he's this radical environmentalist and he's in the asylum, and James Cole meets him in the asylum. You know, I think that Brad Pitt did a really good job there of portraying this not quite sane individual who strangely had some sort of half sane ideas. I thought it was because he did very well with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree. It's one of those coincidental things. I was watching something else where people with mental issues were being interviewed, and I noticed that he must have had some coaching or taken on board some of the characteristics of people that might have had the similar illness to the one that he had was portraying. Because in the documentary I was watching, I just noticed that the physical movements that these people were making, you know, those jerky type movement. And so, yes, I just thought, wow, okay, so he's been coached in that, or he's watched that as well. As far as acting goes, is it right to say minor characters? It's not real. Well, it kind of is. I thought David Morse, he was absolutely perfect for the role that he played. And it's not too much to give away that he's playing the role of the bad guy.
Yes, the Dr. Peters character.
Yeah. Just those things that stood out to me, like, yes, Brad Pitt was brilliant, Bruce Willis was brilliant, Madeleine Stowe. Mm. But, you know, watch David Morse, watch his performance as the bad guy. Brilliant.
Yeah, and one thing that occurs to me about that is, you know, you're supposed to think for a lot of the film that Brad Pitt is the bad guy.
That's right.
And he's obviously insane. Yes. And then there's Dr. Peters, who is actually very sort of, what's the word? He's very much in control of himself. He's kind of normal, inverted commas. And yet, the way it's portrayed, there's a sort of hidden, not quite rightness about the guy right from the word go. So, you know, there's a kind of reversal there of expectations. So I think it was really good.
Very calm, but you can see like this undertone of menace just kind of lurking beneath the surface.
I think in the smile, perhaps. You noticed, Frank, that Frank Gorshin, who we talked about in Batman, the movie, turns up in this film as well. It's amazing.
He played the head psychiatrist in charge of the mental facility that Bruce Willis ends up at in 1990 and later in whatever year, 96 or whatever, when he gets to the right time frame. Frank Gorshin is in there. You asked about the acting. I was watching some of the audio commentary by Terry Gilliam the other day, too. And he was saying that like this movie was like a experiment for all these actors to get into different roles than they were used to. Because like Bruce Willis was known as like an action star. He was kind of getting pigeonholed in that because of Die Hard. Brad Pitt kind of had this like heartthrob role, and actually I didn't take him seriously as an actor. I'm just like, oh, he's just this cute actor everybody liked, whatever, or I'm not interested, you know. And then like when I watched this movie the first time, I'm like, wow, he actually is a good actor. And GK had mentioned about his performance with the mental illness. Gilliam said that he actually had checked himself into a mental hospital for a brief amount of time, and so to kind of like experience it. And he did really study and work very hard to perfect his performance for this. So I agree with that. And I think Madeleine Stowe, she did do a great performance, but I think she's kind of overshadowed by everybody talking about Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Kind of like Dr. Peters is.
I thought she did really well, actually. I thought that she played that kind of scared but caring combination very well, which I thought must have been pretty tricky to do, to be caring about this chap and ultimately falling in love with him, yet kind of scared by him all the way through at the same time. I thought it was pretty tricky, but she did a very good job with that. Bruce Willis, I thought, was Bruce Willis to a certain extent, but I mean he's good, he's really good. But is this prior to Pulp Fiction, where I always remember him with most affection?
Pulp Fiction was 1994 and 12 Monkeys came out in 95, so they're pretty close to back to back.
Frank?
Yeah,
I was gonna say, hey Frank, all the psychiatrists you've ever visited, were they all that attractive?
Well, I just want to say that I like the music. You know, I'm always looking to the musical side of films, of course, naturally enough. That's my background. And I thought that Paul Buckmaster's score was actually pretty good. And the weird accordion music at the beginning was excellent, because it's totally unexpected, isn't it? It doesn't seem to fit with anything. But that,
yeah, I was thinking that it's somewhat French sounding.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that's maybe that's a hat tip to the movie that it's based on. Le Jetty?
Maybe. You're probably right, yes.
Gilliam said something about where he got that theme from. He had like this music he had heard somewhere, and I forget where he heard it, but he liked it so much, but he couldn't think of where to put it in the movie. So he put it at the beginning, finally, when he just couldn't figure anywhere else. You've seen Le Jetty, GK?
No, I just knew that that's what this was based on. And I just assumed, oh, that's a hat tip to the Frenchness of the original. You know, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, no, I watched, it was actually on YouTube quite a while ago. It's basically like a short, and it's, it had some music and just like dialogue in it. Like, you know, they would show a still photo of something, and then that was, you know, you'd hear the talking in French, of course. And the soundtrack in this movie reminds me so much of the French version of this movie. And they're very different stories, I think, but they feel very similar. And the music, I think, really helps drive that home, too.
I haven't actually seen Le Jetty, but the description of it that I read, there are tremendous similarities in plot, I thought. People living underground in Paris, it was a different place, of course. After, it's a nuclear war, World War III, but, you know, a great tragedy. And then there's this time travel with a prisoner sent to sort stuff out, and there's a romance with a woman from the past, and memory as a child of seeing a man killed and a woman present and seeing his own death and that sort of thing. There are some major themes that are the same, but I suppose a lot of peripheral matters which have changed. And
maybe I made that up. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's been a while since I've seen it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Oh yeah, I was talking about the music, and I thought that the really dissonant orchestral style sometimes has that accordion music superimposed over it. Again, a sort of a weird contradiction of ideas, but it really reminded me of the dissonance of Bernard Herrmann's music, which then dovetails neatly into the quotes from Vertigo, which happen in the film, Hitchcock's Vertigo. What did you think of these allusions? You know, obviously, there was Vertigo, and I think the time tunnel was alluded to, various other things as well. Do you think those sort of TV and movie allusions work in the movie?
Well, the one that stood out to me, mainly because I really enjoy their movies, was the Marx Brothers, because, you know, they're crazy, wacky movies. And which one did they show in the background?
Monkey Business.
Monkey Business. Of course it was. Monkey Business. And I thought that was pretty good. I enjoyed that. And then, you know, when they're in the asylum, the cartoons that are playing on the television are always those wacky sort of old cartoons where, you know, someone's getting beaten up or something's going on. There's all this crazy music and all this chaos happening. And then in the setting, there's all this craziness and chaos happening as well. So, and I was thinking, well, maybe they shouldn't have those cartoons on the TV in the asylum, because it probably wouldn't be, you know, lend to people being calm in their confinement there.
No. Do you know, something I thought about Vertigo, you know, Madeleine Stowe plays this character in this film, and I just wonder whether Gilliam chose her because her name is Madeleine, because you could have the character Madeleine in Vertigo.
Yeah, there are all these things that are going on that if you're an aficionado and you like to look at these things, you find all these little things planted in there. Yeah. Some of them are obvious. They're in your face. Like I was just talking about the Monkey Business film, and here we are watching a movie called 12 Monkeys, and, you know, it's somewhat chaotic. So, yeah, no, I enjoyed that side of it.
Okay, did you have any thoughts about these allusions, Frank?
Actually, nothing really jumped out on me. I would just agree with you that a lot of them worked. I didn't watch a lot of Hitchcock movies. I've seen a couple. The Vertigo reference, when they bring it up, it is a little in your face, but you're kind of like, oh yeah, it's kind of similar. Nothing really jumped out at me specifically, though.
One thing I noticed was, I mean, I think I'm right in this. It went past so quickly. I'll have to double check it with you, Frank. But the Weekly World News appeared on one scene.
It did, yes. Batboy. It had Batboy on the cover.
That's right.
Batboy was a really big feature in the 90s of Weekly World News. I think he came out in the 90s. They had found him in a cave, supposedly. Now if you want to follow Weekly World News now, he's like running for president, or he's in some very high visibility role right now. I don't remember quite what it is.
I'm very much looking forward to interviewing him at some point. I'm sure you could help me out with that, Frank.
If you get him on the show, I will be there with questions to interview him.
Although it might be a bit difficult to ask questions of yourself, Frank, but we shall see.
When that appeared, I thought of Frank straight away. You know, just that image of Batboy. I thought, that's Frank.
They used to be in print. I don't know if you guys had them where you guys are at, but here in America, they had them at the grocery store. So they'd be in with all the, you know, tabloid magazines of, you know, this person's marrying this person and cheating with that person. Yeah. Then you'd see this one in black and white compared to all the color ones, and it'd be with all these weird things, and I wasn't sure if it was real or not. I remember reading one article about aliens planning to invade in the spring, and then I was reading it, and I was like, is that really going to happen? And then I finally caught on that it was a joke, you know. But yeah, I would buy that every once in a while, and then the digital age kind of killed it. It's online still, but yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to look at various themes and connections in this movie. And when I say connections, I mean connections to the reality of the situation we find ourselves in at the moment. I mean, this movie was picked up by Truth Stream Media a little while ago with a video production that they made, and they used the film as a kind of springboard to talk about things that are happening there. So I thought, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's look at this film and perhaps be the springboard for our own thoughts. But we'll come to that in a few minutes. Themes in this movie I thought that would be worth discussing. We have a few here. So I want to start with the theme of madness. because this is obviously a big part of what's going on. Cole, James Cole, seems mad to people, and he ends up in this asylum. He's speaking of impossible things. He behaves in odd ways, and he's confused by, you know, things that are really ordinary for us, but to him, they're not ordinary. So madness is something that we're presented with in the movie, but it seems really dependent upon where the characters are coming from, their own background as to how they assess his madness and how he considers people's reaction to him as being sane or not. There are loads of things that are explored in this way. Do you have any thoughts about the way madness is both portrayed and used in the film as a theme? GK, what do you reckon?
Well, I'm asking myself as I'm watching it, what is madness? What do we consider madness? Mm. Because you're watching it and you're going, okay, the people that have seen him and he's trying to explain that, you know, the future's already happened, that sounds completely insane. But from his point of view, he's not insane. This is his reality. It's real. Yeah. And when you look at or you speak to people with mental illness, it always stuns me how normal they really are. You know, other than people that are sort of in a sort of a manic state or they're just doing something completely out of order or strange. Like, for example, just the other day, my wife and I were in town and there was a guy wandering past us and he was waving his arms about and gesticulating wildly, speaking to the air about something, you know, and we kind of looked at each other and thought, well, we didn't say anything, but the look was, perhaps he's one to avoid at this point in time. But from that guy's point of view, he's probably doesn't consider himself having a mental illness, and he obviously was mentally ill. So it just makes me ask the question, what is madness? Because, say, I gave that example because that's a clear example that something's going on. But when you talk to people with mental illness, I'm always amazed just how normal they are, just like all of us. So I guess to wind up here, I'm wondering if we're not all just a little bit mad.
Yes. Yeah.
Honestly, that is my assessment. That's, you know, it sounds funny, but I'm just wondering, you know, we're all just a little bit mad. And what is madness?
Well, I agree. And one of the things that I take from this, whether this is exactly what he means, I don't know. But one of the things I take from it is that I think so many of us are too quick to judge other people as mad. But really what we are doing is we're speaking about things that are going on in our lives, things that are going on in the world from our own worldview perspective. And I think too many people are not prepared to step back one place and ask the question, what is this person's worldview? Or ask worldview questions of each other. We just tend to assume that we all have the same worldview. And if somebody says something that's just a little bit out from that, then, oh, well, they must be not quite right in the head. And I do think there's a warning and a message in that. At least that's what I take from it. Frank, do you have any thoughts about this madness aspect of the film?
Are you divergent too, my friend?
Divergence, yeah, that's the
yeah, I kind of have some thoughts about it. One of my favorite characters was that guy. He had this elaborate fantasy of being a space alien from some planet, and
oh yes,
that's the one who said, you know, are you divergent, my friend? And he was so calm and collected, you know. And he knew he was crazy. But I think one of the things this movie does really well is even though you know it's a time travel movie, it works so well with mental illness, too, that you kind of question, like, is he actually really a time traveler? There are some evidences that confirm it, such as when he's escaping out of that room that would have been impossible. He gets the bullet in his leg, but you do start to wonder.
Actually reminded me, because this is a film that came later, but it reminded me a bit of A Beautiful Mind.
Yeah.
Which poses similar sorts of questions. I mean, by the end of the film, it's pretty much nailed down that, yeah, you know, he was having these hallucinations. But the question is still left hanging in the air, even with that film, as to, was there some truth to him being used by the intelligence services for decoding? And was there something going on there? You know, and it reminded me of that.
I think so. I think it's just something they kind of play with a little bit. And it just kind of makes you question. That's one of those circular things where you question it and you kind of go around in circles. Oh, he's crazy. And then you watch it again. And you're like, oh, no, he's not, you know.
Yeah.
And he is going crazy and he's a time traveler. Keeps you kind of actively watching it, trying to find the details, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you necessarily tap into things of your own experience. Don't you say, oh, yeah, that reminds me of such and such. And it reminded me, actually, you know, one of my heroes is Alvin Plantinga, the American Christian philosopher. You know, one of the things, I don't remember which book it is, but he talks about something along the lines of, you know, knowing something to be true you know, within yourself, you have a conviction. This is because you're talking about the existence of God. You know, you have this conviction. What if you're in a situation where you're surrounded in a particular culture by people who don't believe the same as you? And in fact, there's no evidence of what you believe to be true in this particular culture. Are you therefore rational to continue believing what you believe? Yeah, you are, because you really do know deep within yourself that this is true, even contrary to evidences that surround you. And I thought it just reminded me of that kind of thing going on there as well, because I mean, this character, he knows his beliefs are, of course, challenged by the experiences he goes through, and he doubts himself, and he wants to doubt himself, of course, because he wants to stay in the past with Dr. Riley, because he falls in love with her and all that. So he wants to be sort of disabused of his beliefs. But deep down, he does know that he's going through this. And yet all the evidence around him is going against what he knows to be true. So these sorts of themes, I thought, were in there as well. You know, holding on to what you know to be true. Yeah,
absolutely. And trying to give... Go, Frank, go.
Yeah, I was going to say, and one of the things that makes me doubt his sanity and side with mental illness, at least for a short time, is... shortly after he meets Jeffrey Goins, you know, he has another one of his dreams, you know, and one of the faces he sees in his recurring dream is Jeffrey Goins as the red hair man at the airport. But you see later on in the movie, Jeffrey Goins is not actually at the airport. You know, they just flash him on there for a second. And even I'm doubting myself, did I see Brad Pitt in that scene or not? No, but because that keeps changing, you're like, oh, well, his memory is not reliable. You know, is he crazy?
Yes. Yes. Doesn't the dream change in a number of ways?
It definitely picks up more details as the story progresses and as different details are revealed. I haven't paid close enough attention to that yet, but that's one that jumped out at me. Mm. And that's one way you can think, oh, he may be crazy. You know?
Right, right.
So would it be appropriate now, Julian, to point out that, you know, he's bringing a warning about the future loss of 5 billion lives because of this virus, and because he's talking about something in the future, people obviously are not believing him, and brings in this idea which the Madeleine Stowe character talks about, the Cassandra complex.
Absolutely. Otherwise called the Cassandra predicament, and various other ways of referring to it, doesn't it? Yeah. Do you want to say something about that then?
Well, I'll send you the link to this, Julian, because rather than me try and explain it, I'll just read this little bit for us all, if you don't mind. Mm. The term Cassandra complex has entered the lexicon in 1949 when a French philosopher discussed the potential for someone to predict future events. The complex has been used in wide-ranging contexts. This includes psychology, the circus, how about that, the corporate world, environmentalism, and science in general, and philosophy. Cassandra in Greek mythology was the daughter of Priam, the king who reigned Troy when the Greeks attacked it. Cassandra was such a beautiful woman that she attracted the attention of the god Apollo, the son of Zeus. He gave her the gift of prophecy as a love gift, but when she refused his attentions, he grew angry. Apollo then cursed Cassandra to always prophesy the truth, but have the misfortune of knowing nobody would believe her. So that's just a quick overview of what the Cassandra complex is. And they weave that into the story because when Dr. Rayleigh is giving her presentation, she's talking about the Cassandra complex.
Yeah.
She could prophesy the truth, but no one would believe her. And
that's right.
Always one of the common issues in time travel movies is nobody believes the time traveler.
Well, it's an awful thing to have something that you know or believe to be the truth and to be, you know, totally pushed aside and not believed. Yeah. And it's an awful position. It would be a curse.
Hmm. Yeah, it would. And in your regular day life, that can happen. But I mean, you add into that future prognostications and then it's even worse. I think a similar concept has been explored actually in other time travel movies, like Donnie Darko is one. The Terminator movies kind of play with it, at least the first two. You could view those as like a closed infinity loop like this one if you really wanted.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about the time travel aspect in just a minute. Sure. But specifically, this Cassandra complex kind of idea, you know, applies more widely, doesn't it? And, you know, we have some sort of preacher figure, don't we, in the film, as in a street preacher. You know, he's giving a message. Is it about the end of the world or something like that? And he turns to the Bruce Willis character and says, "You're one of us," doesn't he, at some point?
Yes, you're one of us.
And it has been said that this Bruce Willis character, James Cole, is some sort of Christ figure. He suffers. He has a mission. He has doubts. He's sacrificed in the end. I mean, so it's all very vague, of course, but that's there. And, you know, I'm just thinking it is actually quite difficult, isn't it, to share the gospel, which, of course, we believe to be of, you know, ultimate significance. And yet, you know, we can experience disbelief from people in that. So, you know, obviously, I'm sure that's not what Terry Gilliam was getting at specifically, but that sort of sharing what you believe to be an important message met with incredulity from people can be really, really difficult.
Yeah. That's actually a good observation.
Yeah, I think at some point in our lives, all of us who are believers experience that. And it's just something that we have to live with and just accept that not everyone's going to believe. I think that's what we have to do and not let us affect us, but we just sort of bash on, so to speak, you know, with our lives. You know, I've come to a point, to be honest, I'm past believing. I just know it to be true. But I can also accept that you would either think that I'm mad, that's fine, or you just don't believe it. You just can't accept it. And that's also fine. I think, you know, we have to reach that point, or you could end up being affected by it. And I'm certain some people certainly are.
Yeah, and to extend that more broadly, because obviously we're on TMR here, and as you know, TMR deals with broader issues than just Christianity. And of course, it deals with epistemological issues that have in common. So, I mean, there are things, you know, that concern me, such as, you know, 9/11 and, you know, classic things like JFK and all this. And these are things that people can express deep concern with publicly about. And what happens? People disbelieve what you say. You can be met with complete incredulity in the same sort of way. So it is, you know, a very common experience, you know, right across the board for people.
Right.
Let's come back to this time travel thing then. Well, obviously, this is a really integral aspect of the movie. However, I don't think it's really about time travel. I think that's a bit of a vehicle for the ideas, actually. That's the impression I got, because there doesn't seem to be any real desire to tie up all the ends in making sense of this. I don't think he's really bothered about that very much. But I have, you know, just going into sort of philosophical mode, I do have problems with the idea of time travel. I always have. I personally don't think it's possible, because I think it's actually incoherent. Any thoughts along those lines, chaps?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about time travel. I've, you know, grown up in the 80s and 90s. So, I mean, we had all the time travel movies, you know, Back to the Future and all that. I would say, as far as like time travel movies and stories go, this is probably one of the best ones, because you know how time travel can get very messy. Oh, he went back in time and changed something, and all the fallout from that. But this movie, I think you can view it as basically a closed infinity loop. Is like he went back, but he was not able to change anything, you know. His coming back from the future had no bearing on current events, because nobody believed him anyways. There's analogies of time travel you can see in movies and a couple of video games, where, like, you know, time flows like a river, and if you drop a pebble, say that's your time travel, you drop them into the river, it does nothing to the river, you know. It just keeps flowing over the pebble, you know. If you could assign a dogmatic view with this movie, this would be the view of time travel. You can't. You could go back, maybe, but maybe you can't change anything, you know.
Yeah, I like that aspect of it, that it is affirming that you can't change anything, and I think that's right.
Yeah.
So I'm applauding it from that point of view.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just going a little bit further than that, I actually think, you know, if you can't change anything, it seems to me that's got to be some sort of logical law. You can't change anything. And if you can't change anything, then you can't change anything. I don't see what distinction there would be between sort of important events you can't change and trivial things that you can't change. If you can't change anything, then that's it. You can't change anything logically.
Yeah.
And therefore, you can't even go back in time, because in trivial ways, you know, you're breathing air, you know, molecules are in different positions. And it seems to me there's no reason logically why he couldn't have turned and killed himself as a young child there in the airport. Why not, you know? Why not? He's there. So if he could have done that, then of course that becomes totally incoherent, because then he wouldn't have grown up to be the man to go back in time. And so I think even if you go back and change even the slightest thing, it's a demonstration of the incoherence of the whole notion, you know.
And that's where you get into free will versus predestination, which may be the real thing he's getting at in this movie, maybe, if he is getting at anything. Time travel obviously does make a good vehicle for that. As you say, he could have gone back in time and killed himself as a child. Well, you know, obviously it didn't happen, because he never did do that, you know.
Yes.
See, that's where you get into these. One of these timey-wimey things, as Doctor Who would say, yes. You know.
Well, my own view of this is you cannot go back in time because there is no time that exists for you to go back to.
Right.
I tend to hold to the, you know, the dynamic view of time that the present moment is what exists and everything else is either gone or is yet to come, rather than a kind of block universe, which I think is what is assumed with this kind of time travel thing, that the universe exists timelessly and you can somehow navigate back and forth. I know it's very trendy amongst physicists to believe that kind of thing, but I am not convinced, because I think it has implications for free will. You know, if it's a block universe, then we have no free will.
Yeah.
And I think there are other problems with it as well, which, I mean, we can...
There's a lot of problems with it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, is it created? I mean, from a theological point of view, how can a block universe be created? It just exists eternally alongside God. Well, yeah, okay, but then that's not a created universe, is it? I mean, that's just another problem, but I've got a whole list of problems in my mind.
Well, that's good. Actually... reminds me of a Twilight Zone in the early 2000s reboot or something. To make this a complete time travel and conspiracy episode, I'm about to bring up the Nazis here. So,
yes, I'm glad we're getting them in somewhere, Frank. Excellent.
Yeah, we had to get them in. It's time travel, so they have to have their due.
Yes.
there was one episode of this Twilight Zone where they're in an older time, and this lady, you learn through the course of the story that this lady, she's a time traveler from the future, and somehow she got a job as like a nanny or a caretaker at the Hitler residence. So she's got this mission. She went back in time to kill Adolf Hitler before World War II, so he wouldn't do all the stuff he did. And then finally, towards the end of the episode, what happens is she takes the baby that she thinks grows up to be Adolf Hitler, and she goes and jumps in the river and kills herself with the baby. But another worker from the house followed her, and they know that if she comes back without the baby, she's going to be in trouble. So she just goes and takes and buys a baby from some poor couple, you know, who's clearly not very healthy. And so she takes back this baby who's presumably not healthy or has some problems, mental issues and whatever, and presents it as the Hitler baby. So basically what this episode is saying, that this time traveler not only didn't go back and change anything, Hitler happened because she went back to change it. So it actually created the problem. So, well, there's a saying, history abhors a paradox. So anytime you would try to introduce any sort of a paradox into history, time stream, or I guess, you know, obviously in our view, it would be God, make sure that didn't happen, you know? So basically all that to say is like, you can't change it.
Right. Yes, yes.
To kind of tie this up, I guess, Bruce Willis actually, he didn't actually go back to change it. He just went back to learn about the virus and get a pure sample of it so the scientists in his time could study it.
That's very true, actually. Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's my spiel of time travel for now.
Anything about time travel, GK?
No, you guys have just bent my mind. I'm not sure that I have the intellectual capacity to contribute much here, but I'd just say I concur with you, Julian. I think that we have the now, so time is now, and as you said, the past is past and the future is the future. But I think what a problem many of us have is that we spend a lot of time planning for the future or dreaming about the future or reminiscing about the past without living in the now. Now, I'm not saying either of those things are necessarily negative, because it's not a bad thing to plan for the future, nor is it a bad thing to reminisce about the past. But when we find it difficult, and I'm including myself in this, to live right now in the now, I think that can be a problem. So maybe some of us need to have a word with ourselves about how we live and how we think about time. But as far as the movie goes, the one thing that I don't like about it, the one scene I don't like, and I know it's integral to the whole movie, I don't like the fact that the younger Cole is watching the older Cole be shot and die. Like, how can someone sit and watch themselves being killed? To me, I just can't reconcile that, other than what Frank was referring to as an infinity loop. Then I can go, okay, I can accept that. But, you know, other than that, I think that was the one that was like a bit too far for me.
Well, and that's the thing. As a boy, he didn't know that was his future self, you know? I'm a little boy at the airport, and then some dude gets whacked, and then it was a traumatic event for him, and he just keeps reliving it in his mind.
Yeah.
Is that what worries you about it, the sort of traumatic aspect of it, GK, or the sort of incoherence aspect?
Oh, no, it's just that it's a little bit too much to accept. It's like a step too far for me. Like it's, no, I know it's an integral part of the movie, so I'm undoing the whole thing. But if that wasn't in there, that would have just made the movie a little bit more acceptable for me. If it had been, say, like some sort of a prophecy that had been told or something like that, rather than a dream when we find out that that it's actually him. That's all I'm saying. It's just very personal for me.
I'm kind of with you, actually, and I think that's why I tend to think that the time travel aspect is not, although it's integral, that's how the film works, I don't think it's about time travel. It's a vehicle for all the ideas that are going on there, and as long as I keep that in mind, I don't kind of mind not only the trauma of it, but also what I believe to be the incoherence of it, because I just don't think it's logically possible to do this, but I don't let that bother me, because I just think, that's what he's doing to float all the other ideas in the film. Yeah, so I'm kind of with you there, GK. One thing I wanted to ask, as I said earlier on, was, you know, what we think the connections might be to the present situation that we find ourselves in. I did mention earlier that Truth Stream Media did a very good video recently. Many people will have seen this. And they use this particular 12 Monkeys film as a springboard for discussing many of the dangers presented by this pandemic, in terms of, you know, various controls in our lives seemingly being set in place, which, you know, it does concern me. It concerns a lot of people. I'm sure it concerns both of you as well. I do recommend that people go and see that particular video if you haven't seen that. It's not a video that was full of conspiracy theorizing, you know, in the worst sense of that term. I expected there to be some of that in there, but really it's pretty much devoid of that, but does just present things to be concerned about. So I thought, well, you know, okay, let's perhaps approach this in a similar kind of way. I mean, are there any things about this movie that trigger our own concerns about the current situation?
Well, I think, like in the movie, we're looking at him, he's in 2035, and then he goes back to the world of the 1990s. I think with the current situation, the only thing that I am certain of is that we won't be going back to what life was like in 2019. None of us know what is going to happen. Like, there's no one that knows. We're all guessing. We don't know what the future holds or how we're going to come out of this corona pandemic. You know, what will the world look like afterwards? We're all guessing. We have some ideas, but really we don't know. But the one thing I'm certain of is it won't be the same. And there are some clues. Like, for those people in this movie, the world didn't go back. After this virus hit, the world was totally different. 5 billion people died and the survivors had to move underground. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be extreme as that, but that's because it's just the movie. Yeah. But for us, I'm just certain it won't go back to what we had, let's just say, in 2019. One of the very strong messages here in Australia, as I keep saying about our different states and different territories, is they've locked down the state. So I'm in Queensland. We have one of the tightest border restrictions now between the states, and you actually need paperwork if you want to come into the state or leave the state. And there are reasons you can leave. It's not as if you can't. There are roadblocks. The military and the police and others are there to stop you, but you can leave if you are an essential service worker. If you are, say, returning to Queensland, you're a resident, but if you are returning here, you do have to quarantine. And what I was thinking was, after this, we probably might see a system where you would have to have, say, a card of some sort. Like, now, I'm thinking old world antique, yes, like a card back in the days to move around, like the Gestapo would check your card to see if you could move around between territories. But I read this article, and I'll send you the link to this, Julian, and it's about a COVID-19 public alert system and immunity ID band that could save lives. So I was thinking cards, so I'm thinking back World War II era. Yes. But this is like a band, and it's an organization called LifeKey. I'll read you the article so you get an idea what I'm rabbiting on about here. LifeKey has introduced a new technology that could help prevent the spread of COVID-19 in your community and help people get back to work and travel post-quarantine. We have already built a secure HIPAA compliant platform for you to store and share your personal medical data when it's needed most, said LifeKey CEO Jason Kinsler. This was a logical next step for us that can potentially save lives in the process. LifeKey immunity bands help people get back to work, travel, and daily life by enabling easy, contactless sharing of up-to-date COVID-19 immunity status. By simply tapping the smart wristband with a smartphone, business operators and employers can instantly see whether a patron or employee is cleared for entry by a registered US physician who has vaccinated or tested the person for COVID-19 or its resultant antibodies. Now, unquote here. So I thought this is what we're probably going to see. When this first happened, I thought you'll have to have some sort of a Gestapo-like card, but there'll be a device that might even be on your phone or something on your wrist where you'll have to prove your immunity to COVID before you can move around. One of the things that has been floated here that when they start lifting restrictions was the fact that perhaps people under 30 years old will be the first to be able to move around and go back to work. Because they were saying that there might be some resentment by the younger generation who are being so tightly restricted when the risk is mainly for older people like myself. And so they're thinking they might have to let the under 30s out of the cage first. So they're just a couple of things that I was thinking about in terms of, will we ever get back to what it was before? Well, in the movie, it never did, and I don't think we will. But what it really will look like, I can't say. I've just got some thoughts and ideas, and so do others.
Yeah, and in fact, I get the impression there are people who are celebrating this notion that life will not return to what it was before. And that's, I think that's what worries me. There seem to me to be a lot of vested interests out there who have been just waiting and preparing for such a thing to come along so that they can say, hey, look, this is the brave new world we can start to manage. Mandate in various ways. It really does bother me. And we've got a list of things that people are pointing to at the moment. You know, the cashless society that we've been seeing gradually grow up over the years. Well, now it seems to be the thing to go to because people don't want to take cash because of the possibility of transferring virus, especially on these sort of new plasticized notes. And we have the notion of mandatory vaccination really kicking in because, oh, yeah, we need this herd immunity. We've all heard this phrase, herd immunity, more than we've ever heard it before. And, you know, if we don't all take these vaccinations, we're not going to be doing our due diligence as citizens to help each other through this herd immunity. And we've got universal basic income as something which, of course, is actually a reality temporarily to some extent. But again, it's something that's been put forward as a something for the future. And people are talking, well, maybe this sort of thing needs to carry on in the future. And we've got digital ID, which is the kind of thing that you're hinting at there, more than hinting at there, GK, as something which could actually become permanent, attached to the idea of a vaccination record to do with the answer, the supposed answer to this outbreak.
That's right. The
exit strategy, I noticed. Yeah. It's not, I mean, there are these treatments that are being talked about. I mean, hydroxychloroquine with zinc is one big one that I know is being looked at, but there are a number of these sorts of treatments. But I noticed they're all sort of put on the sideline and, oh yeah, it's being looked at, and all the media will talk about is we're waiting for a vaccine, you know. And I just think, well, hey, there are other ways of dealing with this, aren't there? I just get the impression all that is being sidelined because people like Bill Gates saying, you know, this is the way forward, you know.
Yeah, well, and also that making certain aspects of the way out compulsory. For example, our Prime Minister is spruiking the idea of this phone app that they're using in Singapore, which will make it easier to do contact tracing. So you have to have this app switched on your phone, and it detects everybody that you've been in touch with. Yeah. And what he's actually saying is that if 40% of the Australian population don't take this app voluntarily, then we will have to take it compulsory. It will become compulsory. You'll have to have this app on your phone. It will have to be switched on. Now, they haven't said what will happen to you, not that I've saw, if you don't, but you can imagine as well, you're not leaving your house until you have that app and have it switched on. I could see that being a position that they might take. Mm. And of course, some of these are for good reasons. So we've got to be careful we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because none of us here are saying there isn't a danger here from this virus, but it's just what will happen afterwards. What yeah. paths will we take to get out of it? And then what things will never go back to the same as they were? What will we have to do that's compulsory? Things like these apps. Mm. Another thing that I've noticed too is some of the more liberal states and nations on the planet, well, they're really some of the ones who are taking some of the strictest measures in place. Now, there's a certain state in Australia, we're looking at you, Victoria, where you cannot you cannot go fishing. You can't go and throw a line in the water, go fishing on your own, but you can get on a bus with a heap of other people. That just does not make sense. why can't a person take their boat out on the coast somewhere and do a bit of fishing on their own or with one other person, whereas that same person can get on a bus or a tram with dozens of other people? Yes, they might be, you know, practicing social distancing, but you're still in an enclosed cocoon, whereas you'd be in the open air in your own boat. These things just don't make sense. And this is what a lot of us here are finding confusing between the different states. So that's a very liberal, small L liberal state, but they got some of the tightest restrictions in this country. So there's some of the things that I scratch my head about as well.
Frank, any thoughts about this?
I think you guys are really right that we do need to be concerned. What road do we take to get out of this? Now, you do see all the Bill Gateses and these people wanting all these like draconian things to make sure this doesn't happen again. And you know, how far do we go? Like, and how long do we do this? You know, is it going to be forever? And especially when you do bring up the hydroxychloroquine, there are treatments that can treat this supposedly really quickly. I'm almost wondering if we're, you know, as a sideline, if we're not going to learn that Boris Johnson, he had corona.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if he didn't on the sly take some hydroxychloroquine and that's going to be coming out in the papers or something. I don't know.
I think I may have dropped that thought to you on Facebook, didn't I, Frank?
Well, I mean, you dropped it. I have been watching some videos on YouTube that suggested it, and it would make sense because he was in intensive care and 2 days later he's out. I mean, that's unheard of.
Let's make this let's make this absolutely clear that neither of us say we believe that that actually has happened. It's just that it's a thought, isn't it? You know, a possibility that something like that has happened. And I do want to just be careful of this kind of thing, because I did notice that there was some very definite fake news that came out about Boris Johnson that went viral about him perhaps not even having COVID-19. This is really interesting from the point of view of looking at the reality of fake news out there, because there is a website called Dorset Eye. Of course, that piques my interest because that's where I was brought up, in Dorset, which calls itself Independent Citizen Media. And they published an article, and this is on the 12th of April, called "Was Boris Johnson's COVID-19 condition contrived? Quote, possible satire, possibly not. Wow, I met an employee of St. Thomas Hospital yesterday, 2 meters away, of course, who shared something with me which could change the course of Boris Johnson's future. Apparently, when BJ was admitted to hospital, staff were required to sign the Official Secrets Act. Wow. However, two doctors refused and were subsequently sent on gardening leave. Now my source told me that doctors Shirley Knott and Ashley Pullin were disgusted by BJ's flippant attitude from the off, and I quote, he had the most pathetic contrived cough I have ever heard in all my years of practice. I've sent him home with a packet of lockets and a bottle of Kalkoff children's syrup. If he had COVID-19, then I'm not a doctor. Pull in. Proof, if anyone needed, that we the public are being hoodwinked. Anthony George, that's what it says. Then underneath, because of complaints, there's a facilitator update which says, quote, we realise now that this article may well be satire. The names have simply been made up. Either way, the point is that we have a PM who is perceived by millions as a liar and a government who have handled the COVID-19 crisis in a chaotic and often criminal way. So they say, we do, however, apologise to those who may initially have believed this article was 100% factual without satirical substance, end quote. And I just thought that was interesting as a piece of very obviously fake news. And I think they were, personally, I think they were irresponsible to publish that in the first place. But it's done very well for them. And notice they've got 62,000 odd hits on that article. And I looked to previous ones published in just a little bit before to do with Boris Johnson. Those hits are 400, 53, 3. And the top one I could find was 2,000 and something, which was also one questioning his cough. But this one, which was obviously fake, 62,000. So it does well to publish fake news. So I want to make it quite clear that we today, in discussing these sort of logical possibilities, we're not saying that is the case. We're not engaged in fake news here. But I do take the point, and it did cross my mind that maybe there are people who have been given treatments that are just not available to the rest of us. That wouldn't be impossible, I'm sure.
Yeah, that is highly possible. And I mean, you bring up fake news and that's a whole nother rabbit trail to go down. But
I just wanted to make it clear that we're not doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, what we're doing is like basically speculation. Who knows? Mm. But I think we have one of two paths out of this. One is the continuation of just these crackdowns and, you know, Nazi paper type of things that DK had elaborated on, or we have, if some of these treatments work and it can be contained and dealt with, if treatments are working and if it's not as prevalent as they thought it was going to be, it doesn't make sense to go down the draconian path and lock everybody up.
I do wonder about that, actually, and I'll put a link to this in the show notes, but I don't remember the guy's name, but a GP in America, and he was being interviewed and talking about how he had used a particular regimen to do with hydroxychloroquine and zinc and antibiotics as well, I think. He just decided to do that because of his particular situation. He's in a very built-up area with thousands of people he has to deal with, and he knew that he was going to have this influx, so he prepared himself for this. And this regimen was working. He said it was working incredibly well. He hadn't had any deaths, and it was just remarkable. And the other people on that interview as well were saying things like, in their view, it seemed criminal that this was not being picked up and used widely. And one of the things that crossed my mind was, you know, I know that this is being looked into, but it's so slow. And here in the UK, physicians are being advised not to use this treatment until it's proven that it's safe and all this. And yet this is this involves medication that's been used for decades. I'm just wondering what pressures there might be. And again, this is speculation. What pressures there might be to suppress this, because what is in view by those with a great deal of power and standing to make a great deal of money, vaccine is the great salvation. I'm just wondering what pressures there are, you know, bearing upon the whole system.
I mean, that's,
again, it's speculation.
No, it's good to speculate. And I think you're not unwarranted to do so, because, you know, how do you make money as a drug company? A, you know, one-time regimen of hydroxychloroquine, you know, or do you make it on selling people vaccines for this every year? You know, which one is more profitable? Trump is pushing the hydroxychloroquine and the media here is pushing back on it, but the FDA is looking into it as an option. And I think if the FDA approves it and finds that it is effective, then we can take the other path out of there, in which we don't have to go down the path to start living underground like they did in the movie. You know, you have another option to contain and deal with the threat of this virus.
Well, let's hope that sort of thing can happen.
I hope so. I'm very hopeful.
Well, yes, but I do fear that the technocrats of this world, those with that kind of worldview, you know, are salivating and thinking, you know, this is our opportunity now to make things go in that kind of way. And
I agree.
I fear that there are people who don't want other solutions for various reasons, money being a big part of it,
right.
Of course.
I agree. Yeah, absolutely agree. And I think that's kind of one of the points in the movie, too, is, you know, that's why they sent James Cole back to collect information about the pure form of the virus so they could cure it in their time, not prevent the virus. See, they were sending all these time travelers back to get the virus, to study the pure virus so they could bring it back to the future or whatever and cure it then.
Yeah, that's an aspect that I didn't understand, Frank, because why would you want to get an old form of the virus in order to develop a vaccine or whatever? Wouldn't you want to deal with the current form of the virus?
You would, but I think I'm thinking what their logic in the movie was is, if you get the pure form of the virus, you get the 100% pure genome and you can derive a vaccine for all forms of the virus that came after it, maybe.
And
the reason why they want him to do that and want to cure it in their own time is because if he goes back and changes the past and prevents the virus, their jobs don't exist. You know, they're not in power.
Yeah. Not thought of that. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the things I picked up, you know, from seeing this movie, is like, they want to cure it in their time so they can secure their power. Yeah, you know,
the world can return to the surface of the earth, but they would still be the great technocrats in charge of the whole thing.
Exactly. That's one of the points of the movies, whether intentionally or not. Yeah.
Oh, heavens. I missed that, Frank. That's bad, isn't it?
I've watched this movie like 8 times. So.
Right. Okay.
And I've thought about this and time travel quite a lot, so it's okay.
And I like the little joke towards the end where one of those technocrats is sitting on the plane beside the bad guy, and he says, "What do you do?" And she says, "I'm in insurance."
Yes.
And that line bugged me for years. And I'm just like, what the heck did she mean? Yeah. And I read online theories, and I think that's kind of what shaped my opinion just now, is like, she came back just to ensure that the virus spread. Yeah. And then she can collect the sample of it.
Ooh.
That's what made me think about what you were saying. Yeah. 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 Good. Eh? Yeah, good. Good.
She can get the pure virus right there. And then she can also make sure that it spreads, and then everything, it's a total win for her, you know?
Yeah. I'm in insurance.
Wow. So there is actually a conspiracy there in the film.
I think there is. Yeah. You don't, it's not overt, but I think it's there.
Hey, can I, this will be a prediction from me, and this is not the Cassandra complex coming out here.
Prediction.
Prediction. I think the social distancing thing will stay. I think we'll be expected to do that well into the future. And some of the bigger companies are already preparing for this because I read online the Ford factory workers are going to be handed wristbands and they will buzz if you get too close to each other. So there could come a time when all of our phones will buzz if we're too close to somebody else.
Yeah.
So my prediction is that is one thing that will definitely continue for some time. But I think the one thing that would definitely be with us forever will be more controls on your movement. There'll be restrictions on movement. We just won't be able to do what we did before, you know, grab a passport and go anywhere in the world we like. They're already talking about taking blood tests at the airports before you get on the plane.
It is very worrying. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we just won't be going back. So whether those things come to fruition or not, I don't know. But my prediction is social distancing for a while and restricted traveling forever. And I could even see them restricting interstate travel here in my own country, just going from state to state.
And you do agree that there are people who actually rather like the idea of this?
Oh, I'm totally on board with that. Yes, because you can see it coming out in some of them even now. Like I say, some of our leaders are rubbing their hands together at this, and some of them are taking it so far that you think, you know, are they putting us on? Are they pulling our leg here? You know, for example, in Australia, you can be arrested and fined for sitting in a park reading a book, but it's all very well to, like I said before, jump on public transport with a dozen other people. It just doesn't make sense. And they're the sort of things that make me scratch my head and go, you know. And, you know, I want to be supportive of, you know, what our leaders are saying to get us out of this. And I don't want to see people who are vulnerable getting sick or dying from it. So I want to be on board. But sometimes I think some of these things are going that far that I'm wondering if it really is a leg pull just to see what they can do.
Testing the waters to see how far.
Is that a bit much?
Testing the waters, I think. I mean, this is the kind of thing that Pat Wood has been talking about for years, analyzing things in terms of technocracy. As I've said on the show many times, I find that a very useful sort of interpretive framework to understand how things are shaping up. And this seems to be a big move in that direction. And it certainly connects with something that a lot of people are pointing to, which is the way the UN has been wanting people to have digital identification. They've been wanting that for years. It's part of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, number 16.9, by 2030. This is a quote. It says, by 2030, to provide legal identity for all, including birth registration. And a lot of people are also pointing to ID 2020, which is this corporate alliance, which is advocating digital identity globally. And that has partners such as Microsoft, surprise, surprise, Gavi, which is the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, which is also a Bill Gates thing, and the Rockefeller Foundation. You know, there are lots of vested interests here pushing towards that kind of thing through the UN, a very technocratic mentality with power to pull a lot of levers in the world, pushing for the very kind of thing which is being touted as the very kind of solution to the problems we find ourselves in. Surprise, surprise. And I just, you know, metaphorically have this image of all these kinds of individuals just waiting to jump at the slightest sign of a problem like this. The problem comes along and they're jumping, you know, and it's very worrying.
Never let a good crisis go to waste.
A great quote, isn't it? And so true. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Or in the terms of Supertramp, crisis. What crisis?
Thank you. Oh, dear.
A bit of a non sequitur there somewhat, but let's move on.
Actually, I wanted to throw a quote in here to do with the sort of conspiracy angle of all this, because, of course, there's the looking back sort of conspiracy angle as to, well, where did this come from? And I think this is something which I certainly don't want to pin my colours to the mast at all on this, because I think there are so many competing narratives out there as to where this came from, who might be behind it, whether it was natural or not, and all this. And I find it so bewildering at the moment that I cannot commit myself to any view on this. And there's one thing I did want to share this quote, which I thought was really good, actually. This was from Caitlin Johnston. A few weeks back, she wrote a piece called "It's Okay to Be Uncertain What's Happening and Where This Is All Going." And it's a great quote. There's this weird dynamic in conspiracy and anti-establishment circles where everyone wants to pretend they know exactly what's going on. And those who express uncertainty tend to attract less interest and attention than those who claim forcefully and assertively to have a crystal clear HD perspective on the big picture. This dynamic has led to the rise of many professional fringe pundits who don't actually have much going for them other than the ability to communicate in a confident tone, and it's created a very confusing information ecosystem during the current pandemic. And today, I am just writing to say that it is actually okay to simply not know for a bit. And that's, end quote, that's the situation I'm in on this one. I'm saying I do not know, and I think it's okay to not know. And anybody listening, if you find yourself confused about all this as well, it's okay not to know. And I'm not saying for one moment, I don't think anybody should be looking into questions as to where this came from. And I do have my suspicions about it being engineered and escaped and all that kind of thing. But, you know, I think it's okay for all of us to say, we don't know. And I think there is a great strength and benefit to be had from biding your time on questions like this and come back, you know, perhaps months later and say, ah, no, it's much clearer. Now let's talk about it, rather than jumping straight in and, you know, perhaps having to revise your opinions or being embarrassed and all this kind of thing. So, you know, I thought that was a very good warning that she gave there, and I found that very helpful.
Yeah, I think that's a good approach to take to it. Like I say, the only thing I'm firm on is that just we won't be going back to 2019.
Yeah.
And, of course, we've talked about time travel's not possible, so we're not going back there. But is it all right to ask you guys a couple of questions? What, during this crisis period, what things have been unavailable besides toilet paper where you are? So let's start with you, Julian, if you don't mind me asking.
It's very bizarre, actually, isn't it, this toilet paper business? I read somewhere that the lack of toilet paper was a feature of some other crisis. I don't know what that crisis was. And therefore, this meme has been sort of circulating thereafter, where people are thinking, oh, the first thing to go is going to be toilet paper. Let's get hold of that. So maybe that's how that happened. But the other thing that I've noticed is soap has been difficult to get hold of. Hand sanitizer, of course. But I mean, a lot of normal things, at least where we are, we're in, you know, normal supply, but you know, obviously Mark lives in London and he's shown me pictures of empty shelves all over the place. It depends really where you're actually living, but we're just sort of on the edge of countryside here, so it's more relaxed. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism of people for panic buying, but you know, people are being very selfish. But actually, I think the thing that was driving people was fear rather than being selfish, you know.
I agree.
Frank, did you notice anything besides toilet paper?
I had quite a few interesting observations, because I had actually stocked up a little bit on some things, you know, food and like, because I live in California anyways, not far from Los Angeles, and it's kind of a good idea to have food stocked up anyways, and I wanted to, so it's a good excuse. So when this hit, I kind of went to the stores just to see it, you know, and just to pick up some regular groceries, and some things I noticed were gone that I was just amazed by was the first thing I noticed was all of the onions were gone. I walked into Walmart, all of the onions were gone. Garlic, understandably, was gone. Potatoes were gone, which is a good one to get in a survival thing. So I understood that. I think eventually, like a couple of days into it, all of the produce was gone except avocados. I was actually more amazed by some of the things that were not gone, actually.
You mentioned cheese balls to me, Frank.
They had huge bins of cheese balls, like these huge, like 5-gallon tubs of cheese balls that did not get sold out at all. I think I was one of the few who actually bought one. Pickled herring was left on the shelf. I like pickled herring, but at $8 a bottle, I could understand why it had been left. One bag of frozen fish fillets had been left when all of the meat had been cleared out.
Well, everything you guys have just spoken about resonates here. So, but a couple of things I might add. One of the most unusual things that I noticed and has been talked about in the media were tinned tomatoes. The tinned tomatoes flew off the shelves. Now, I'm not sure why that is. Any thoughts?
I suppose they're quite versatile and they keep. They go with a lot of staple food that people eat. Bolognese.
Yeah, well, with that was the pasta. Yeah. So I guess people were probably going to have a lot of pasta dishes. But right now, a lot of those things have settled down. So toilet paper is sort of getting back to normal. There's no hand sanitizer to be seen anywhere. But one of the things now that's in big demand is flour and cake mixes.
Yes.
So everybody's staying home and baking.
Yeah. What about cheese balls, GK? Are they being left on the shelves?
can't comment. Haven't noticed that. I'm sorry.
Oh, you need to next time.
But I would have taken one.
Oh, you would have taken one. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a research project for you.
The good news is the chooks are back in the store now. So
the chooks are back. Yeah. Yes. Chooks
are back. GK, it's
frozen or roasted. Go on.
I leave you with a challenge. It's an official TMR research project for you now to report back about cheese balls. Because I want to. Yes, please.
See what I can find.
Okay, so just before we do the ending to the podcast, is there anything that you feel we've missed out? Are there any sort of conclusory remarks that you want to say about the film itself? We were talking about a film, weren't we, earlier on?
I'm done.
You're done?
I'm done. I sort of gave my opinion as we went along, I think. About the film and about the current crisis. I mean, I know I can be a somewhat opinionated person. I don't know why people would say that. But
we all can. Frank, anything conclusory or are you done as well?
I would like to maybe double back on you did mention how James Cole is supposed to be a Christ figure. And that does seem to happen in time travel movies here and there. Sort of a savior figure. In a couple of cases, they actually do use the JC, you know, Jesus Christ, piggybacking on that. So you have James Cole. Yeah, then you have John Connor in the Terminator series. I don't know if they did that intentionally or not, but it's definitely an interesting note, you know.
Yeah, indeed. You got a sharp eye there. Have you noticed Julian Charles as well? But anyway, that's another
matter. I did. I did not. Actually. I wanted to sound like I did, but no, I didn't. So you're a time traveler and you're...
That's right. Yes. I'm from the future. I'm putting everything right.
Now I know why you were poo-pooing it so heavily. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you ever so much, both of you, for coming on for this third in the row of podcasts here. It's been a really, really enjoyable discussion. I'm not sure how on the ball I've been earlier in the morning than usual, but really good. And a lot of interesting ideas come out. And it'd be nice to have this opportunity as well to talk about things that are going on in the world at the moment. And no doubt here at the podcast, we'll follow up on some of this. Hopefully be speaking to Pat Wood about these sorts of things. That would be great. I'll get in touch with him and see if that's a possibility. One thing I wanted to say, I mean, Light Flint Radio is still going out there, GK, isn't it? But you've got a new project, haven't you, with your Philosopher Rock podcast. How's that going these days?
Well, we're in our early stages, Julian. Thanks for bringing it up. Yeah. Like Flint Radio is still happening, but we've got the new show, Philosopher Rock, philosopherrock.com. Yeah, we're just trying to find our way. We're trying to get a bit of traction. It's a podcast series where we explore the philosophies and the worldviews of rock and roll. And we analyze them to see if these rockers are saying anything that we maybe should apply in our lives or whatever. So it's not a put down. It's not anything like that. It's just, hey, what are they saying? What does it mean? And what does it mean to us? And, you know, are the things that they're saying livable or is there another alternative viewpoint? So really that's what it's all about. So thanks for the opportunity to talk about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And also thank you for inviting me on board. I really enjoyed spending this bit of time with you and Frank as always. And it's a real honor to be on your show. So thank you, Julian.
Oh, thanks, GK. Obviously, I'll put a link to your podcast there in the show notes. Even add it to the links page. Occasionally, adding things occasionally. And thanks ever so much, Frank, also for coming on. Ancient Aliens Debunked, the actual website was down for a long time, but it's back again, isn't it? Is your research back up there now, Frank?
I don't know. I haven't looked at it. I had blogs up there at some point. The site came down and then it was redirected to the movie on YouTube. Chris White, I hear, is back now, so I haven't been in touch, but I don't know what's going on with it right now.
Okay. Well, it is back anyway, isn't it? So I always refer to you as being associated with the Ancient Aliens Debunked website.
Ancient Aliens Debunked stuff has happened and may continue to happen depending on what the future holds. I don't know. Thank you, I guess, for having me on the show. I always love talking with you and GK, and I would recommend people to check out the Philosopher Rock show. I've listened to the first two episodes. They are pretty cool. Dio was the first two. The next one is Jethro Tull. That's on my list to listen to, so it's a good show.
Thanks ever so much, both of you. Great discussion. Look forward to speaking to you again when we talk about something equally interesting. I don't know what it would be. Perhaps a carry-on film or something. So anyway, speak to you again. Thanks ever so much for coming on.
Hooroo.
Hooroo.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Forever, and you'll never be back.